Hi, everybody. Welcome. I think you got your introductions done, so maybe let's just jump into it. So I think I know, but what exactly are psychedelics?
Psychedelics, for those who don't know, there's quite a lot of discussion about how do we actually define them at this point in time. There's a lot of discussion from activists, investors, entrepreneurs, indigenous community members in terms of how do we describe this class of compounds. One demarcation that has been used is basically like, you know, tomatoes biologically are fruits, whereas in terms of trade law are vegetables. Psychedelics, in kind of this parody sort of sense, are similar. There's a lot of different opinions on how they can be classified, but generally when we think about psychedelics, we're talking about a class of molecules that have a propensity to increase neuroplasticity within the mind of an individual. And the way that we define neuroplasticity is the ability of neurons that wouldn't typically communicate with one another to be able to start communicating with one another. So for instance, if an individual goes to war, has some sort of trauma that they're exposed to, a friend dies in combat, typically there will be a neural looping that will form in the brain of that individual. What a psychedelic can do and why they've been proven to be so effective medically and medicinally is that you can have neurons communicate with one another that wouldn't traditionally communicate, break that neural firing that is caused by that PTSD or that trauma, and allow for that individual to process that and move on with their lives in a better way. So that's a general definition.
Wow.
I'll just add that the word itself, psychedelic, since we're in Canada, was coined by a British psychiatrist living in Canada, who is also Canadian, and it means mind manifestation. So that, yeah.
Now, it's certainly a topic that's getting a lot more interest. But why do you guys think that's happening?
I can start. So one is the potential of psychedelic therapy for mental health. That's a big reason that this topic is making, it's the reason we're basically here on the stage today. Clinical trials are now showing that psychedelics have the potential to treat PTSD, treatment-resistant depression, eating disorders, addiction issues, social adjustment disorder, and the potential, as seen in the clinical trials, is enormous. I think, Marieke, if you want to speak to that a bit.
Yeah, there's many different compounds that are currently going through clinical trials. There's dozens and dozens that are happening right now. And so the FDA, kind of being the governing body, at least in the United States, that is moving these compounds through. The FDA has actually been super excited to support psychedelic therapeutics moving through that pipeline and that process. And so compounds like LSD, like ecstasy or MDMA, ibogaine, and many other novel compounds and molecules, NCEs, novel chemical entities, are all moving through. You know, some of the things that are happening in the world of drug development in this space are, can you actually have a psychedelic without the trip, without the hallucinogenic effects? So for instance, with someone who has traumatic brain injury, do you want them to have, you know, a humongous, life-changing, altering experience visually and auditorily, or do you just want them to benefit from that neuroplasticity and be able to heal that traumatic brain injury? So there's many different compounds, many different companies that are now moving these compounds through the FDA approval process, and we, you know, are seeing this across the entire globe. Australia just legalized MDMA and psilocybin for therapeutic use. We actually brought psychedelic education to Davos around the World Economic Forum last year and got to educate folks like John Kerry and Rob Smith on psychedelic-assisted therapy. So now Europe is very much on board. And just a couple weeks ago, we flew in from Dubai, where we hosted the first ever psychedelics conference in the Middle East. And so even the Middle East is super interested in beginning to roll out psychedelic-assisted therapy. So it's a really exciting time. And everyone is just trying to figure out what they want to focus on, which indication paired with which psychoactive psychedelic compound.
Yeah, and one more thing to add to that, just in terms of what we're seeing, like in phase three clinical trials for MDMA, 67% of the people that went through that trial no longer show signs of PTSD at a 12-month follow-up. This is leagues better than anything else we have right now. And traditional antidepressants and SSRIs, there hasn't been a lot of development or innovation for about 50 years. So to have something helping people at that, those kinds of rates that you don't have to take daily, is really revolutionizing the field.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that the FDA is looking at this, but where are we in the approval process for Health Canada and the FDA?
I'll touch on the FDA. You can touch on Health Canada. But basically, so MDMA is the soonest to be rolled out. So we're expecting that by spring of next year, we're going to have, you know, full approval in the beginnings of commercialization and rollout of MDMA within the United States. That means globally, since a lot of the globe follows the FDA as kind of that first pin, we'll start seeing that rollout as well. And typically, you get an average of a three-year timeline for other countries that begin to follow the FDA post that rollout. So MDMA will start to roll out in the States likely in summer of next year, psilocybin probably towards 2025, but we're quite close to both of those.
Yeah, and I'll just speak to, Marieke mentioned before, in Australia, starting actually 2 days from now, July 1st, MDMA and psilocybin will be legal for therapeutic use. In Quebec, patients have now started to receive psychedelic-assisted therapy. British Columbia is also on the frontier of this, so we're making perhaps faster progress here than in the U.S.
Wow, that's amazing. Why would companies want to offer this as a benefit?
Yeah, so that's the line of work that I'm in, which is offering this as a benefit to companies that they can offer to their employees. And it's really fascinating how enticing of an offer it is, because employers are seeing that when their employees are suffering from mental health, it's costing them in terms of absenteeism, it's costing them in terms of retention, it's costing them in terms of productivity. There's another word that isn't as common, like presenteeism. Are we, when we're at work, how present are we? In increased medical costs. So employers are really excited to find solutions to, one, all of these costs that are adding up, and two, hopefully they care about their employees' mental health.
Yeah. And what are your sort of thoughts about early adopters who are considering this? Like,
yeah, so to tell you a little bit about Entheia, the insurance company I founded to offer insurance plans to early adopters, what we're seeing is that, one, even Fortune 100 companies are open to and interested in offering this to their employees. They have been seeing since COVID the amount and increase of people suffering from mental health, people asking for mental health time off. Actually, for Gen Zers and millennials, burnout and mental health issues is the number one reason they're leaving work. So we are seeing an tremendous amount of interest from early adopters to be able to offer this to their employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's also a lot of just passion about this movement right now, also culturally. There's a lot of, you know, C-suite executives that are beginning to come out of the, you know, psychedelic closet and talk about how psychedelics have benefited themselves, their families, and so they're interested in offering this to their own employees because it's benefited them, as well as the very quantitative benefits that it can provide to a company that maybe wants to save on other health benefits by providing this type of service.
Yeah, and just one more thing on that. What's an incredible trend is seeing when C-suites or founders or people in those kinds of positions have had their own personal psychedelic experience, or they've seen a family member transform through psychedelic therapy, and then they're coming to us saying, hey, we know this works. How do we get this to more people?
Yeah. And so what's your sort of sense about the future in terms of how things are going to roll out in the next little period?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many different, you know, perspectives and aspects to really look at this at. If, you know, our firm really just looks at above ground opportunities that are non-state by state dependent in the US. So this is medicalized, this is going through the FDA approval process. But there are groups that are looking to capitalize or build companies that are state by state dependent or functioning in other jurisdictions. You know, we were just talking with some of the folks here that, you know, there's, I believe, like a shop called Shrooms in Toronto already beginning to sell this. A lot of these companies that are kind of in the gray area are also popping up state by state, not fully legal, but either gifting psilocybin in one way or another. For us, I think that there's a lot of you know, questions about how does that roll out, how does that happen. We do see, you know, psychedelics, traditional psychedelics at least, like psilocybin and LSD, you know, they don't have any known lethal dose, they're non-addictive, non-habit forming, but there are other problems that can come from them. Folks who are already predisposed to bipolar disorder or schizophrenia can have a triggering experience that can actually reveal that if they have a family history of it. And so having, you know, psilocybin, mushrooms, LSD, et cetera, or other psychedelics available in corner stores might not necessarily be the best solution. One solution that's been proposed is basically having a psychedelic driver's license. And so basically being able to receive, you know, 14 hours of training about how to create the perfect set and setting for yourself, how to hold space for others, what types of compounds, at which dosages, do you have this family history that you need to be aware of, and only once you've been trained, being able to have access to this type of infrastructure that is less formal than a medicalized prescribed treatment. So, you know, we could talk for hours about it. We just came from a 5-day conference with 500 speakers talking about, you know, their own opinions about how psychedelics should roll out. But those are just, I guess, some of the conversations that are currently happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
And one of the things you touched on it that I kind of want to bring us to remember is that the reason there's so much buzz about this is people are suffering, especially since COVID, the amount of people that are suffering from anxiety, depression, probably even people in this room. We hear like touching, heartbreaking stories every day about how people are feeling and how hopeless they feel. So when we talk about the future of psychedelics, we mean addressing a huge need of people that are suffering and the importance of doing that safely with the right harm reduction protocols, making sure we are catering to adverse events and controlling for that as well.
For sure. And we'll open up for questions in just a second. But like, say someone's in that situation right now, we're in this sort of gray zone where we're moving towards approval. And what would you suggest to someone who wants to try something like that or get involved in that? How do they go about that? Or what are your thoughts on that at this point? Or are they just sort of pushing their company to think about that?
So the place that a lot of different folks start are either legal retreat centers that are located outside of the United States or outside of Canada. So that can be a good place. There's some really high quality ones that we're happy to refer people to. Also ketamine clinics. Ketamine is not a categorical psychedelic. It's a dissociative, but has many of the same effects that psychedelics do. And there's actually more and more researchers that are coming online touting for the benefits of ketamine. It does have downsides as well, like any substance or compound. But it can be a really good solution for folks that are looking to access this type of treatment with this type of efficacy in the short run is the ketamine clinics that are available across the entire globe at this point.
Right. We've got about 10 minutes left. Does anyone have questions? Sure, go ahead back there. So the question was about using psychedelics in integration, I think. So.
Yeah, that's a really important point. So for those in the room that don't know the word integration, I'm just going to go a little bit of a overview of how psychedelic therapy works. You start with preparation. So before you even do any psychedelics, you're talking to your therapist about what your intentions are and what you're trying to achieve, what problem you're trying to address. You'll then do 1 to 3, depending on the compound, medication sessions. So that's psychedelics with a therapist. And then none of this we've seen in the clinical trials has the same effect unless we do integration. And what that integration work does, it's working with a therapist post for the weeks following the treatment to really integrate the lessons we learn during the psychedelic therapy session so that they become lifelong lessons. So it's really important if people do decide to go to retreat centers in Jamaica or Costa Rica or wherever they're being held, that they have created for themselves an avenue to do the integration for 4 to 6 weeks following.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And that actually is one of the main criteria that a lot of retreat centers will reject participants for, is if, you know, one of the questions that's asked by more responsible retreat centers is, do you have a community at home that can support you through your integration process, that can really hold space for you after this? Because, you know, you might not necessarily have, you know, a completely euphoric, wonderful experience. You might have a really challenging experience that you need to process over weeks and months of time. And without the proper community, without the proper support, the efficacy of that treatment just won't necessarily go as far. The other point that I'll touch on that I think is super just interesting to think through is this is really the first time that we're taking both a drug and a therapy in combination through the FDA approval process. You know, for anyone who's interested in more holistic modalities, ways of really looking at the whole human context and experience to be able to treat illness, you know, this is probably the main point and kind of shifting moment in our healthcare systems to allow for that to happen. With taking both the drug and a therapy through, we're beginning to kind of move away from this more biochemical focused understanding of disease and really thinking through more of a holistic lens. And so that's what, you know, a lot of us are super excited about, is that, you know, we're not just, you know, taking a drug to market, we're taking a very novel therapy to market that can inform how we think about food as medicine, how we think about community as medicine, how we think about all of these different things that we all benefit from but aren't currently incorporated in our medical systems, and how do we get the most out of them to be able to keep ourselves healthy and joyful.
Other questions? Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, so we actually issued the largest review study on microdosing to date just a few months ago. What we found through that research, and it was actually University of Toronto were some of the researchers we were working with. So what we found is basically there's no conclusive evidence on microdosing yet. There's definitely a lot of studies, but they are not necessarily to par or as high quality as we would like them to be. So there is a lot of hype right now. There's a lot of excitement, and microdosing could work. It could be super effective. It's just the rigor of the studies has not been there to give us conclusive evidence that it does work. So if it's benefiting you, if people are enjoying it, you know, and you feel that you have a good relationship with it, then it might be something worth exploring, because it might work. It's just the science hasn't necessarily proven it yet. It's created some really interesting dynamics with state-by-state, you know, regulation in the U.S. because, you know, for Oregon, for instance, they were rolling out, and the doctors, the therapists, the policymakers were like, we should just be doing high dose experiences of psychedelics because that's what we have the clinical evidence for. Whereas citizens were on the other side and saying, we want our microdoses. And so there's also kind of now conflict between citizenry that has kind of rode this media wave of microdosing is amazing, and then a lot of the clinicians, scientists, and therapists who have only seen really high dose therapy work in that setting. But, you know, we're still yet to find out. So we'll see what happens in the next couple of years of science.
And I think there's another question somewhere in there. And I'm just going to repeat the question when you're done, just for the audio.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think the question was about clinical trials and there being enough funding for those studies, and how you guys as venture on the venture capital side can sort of help with that, or what the situation is around that.
Yeah. So I think in the next 24 months, that'll change pretty drastically. We have to remember that really, you know, psychedelic startups only started popping up, you know, in 2018 were the first few, but there was only enough companies to actually even truly launch a fund and do venture capital probably in the last like 2-3 years. And so we had all of these companies that started and were able to go through pre-seed, seed stage rounds, a little bit of Series A. Now you're getting more companies that are graduating to late Series A, Series B, and that's really where larger financial institutions come in, begin to capitalize it. And there is definitely discussion from a lot of different VCs in the space about kind of who's going to have the first growth stage fund that's going to be writing $5 to $10 million checks for Series B companies and beyond. The biggest problem to date for larger financial institutions coming in, or larger VC firms coming in, has been, you know, one, large LPs, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, et cetera, still don't have enough data, enough trust in this working to be able to begin financing it. And secondly, we haven't necessarily seen, you know, to date, the greatest, you know, drug development operators. Probably until, you know, 12 months ago, we really started seeing more executives coming from big pharma and beginning to enter the space. And so, you know, my business partner, Maria Volkova, she was one of the first people who left, you know, a decade of big pharma to come and join the space and begin operating. But every company we were actually getting across our table, you know, it was a couple tech bros or some folks from Canada cannabis were like, we're going to run a drug development company. And it's just not necessarily, like, those are not opportunities that you can really put those large checks into yet. But I think over the next 24 months, we will see that shift, both in terms of capital as well as the quality of the operators who are trying to run these companies that have a very extensive and, you know, highly capital intensive process to them.
Great. There's another question over there. So the question is there any organized advocacy happening around decriminalization, and what's sort of happening on the state and federal and provincial levels?
Yeah, I can speak to the U.S. and not Canada, unfortunately, but in the U.S. there's a lot of advocacy happening, and it's primarily at the state level. In some states, there's a lot more happening at the more local level, but like in California, state of Washington, in D.C., in Massachusetts, in Oregon, there are states all over the U.S. where there's advocacy happening. You can easily look at which one to support depending on where you live, but they need a lot of support. They need the voices to make this happen. And then that also does get into what are they advocating for? Because as Marieke mentioned, some people are, the citizens are often advocating for microdoses, but the clinicians, the therapists, and the research is pointing in a different direction. And so... Mm-hmm. Choices.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different ways to get involved. Yeah, I can't speak as much to Canada, but in the States, you know, you can just literally look up decriminalization efforts, and they're all looking for folks who want to contribute and volunteer. Yeah, there's also, for those interested, a lot of incredible equity-focused programs on helping increase accessibility. There's a lot of incredible organizations that are specifically focused on indigenous communities and their relationships with plant medicine and supporting those communities. So, yeah, happy to direct folks to resources as well if you come and chat with us.
Quickly add that if anyone in this room is interested and is a new person to this space, I highly recommend watching Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind on Netflix, or read the book, even better. But if you don't have time to read the book, watch the series on Netflix.
So we've got just 1 minute left. Maybe give a sense, when you're looking at the landscape of psychedelic drugs, which are you sort of think are most promising?
Our answers may be different. For me, it's definitely MDMA and psilocybin, followed by LSD, just based on clinical trials and where we are at. MDMA's schedule is looking like it's going to be rescheduled next year. It's already being used in Australia and parts of Canada and Israel and parts of Europe. So MDMA first, then psilocybin. Those are the most exciting compounds for me, and I think will be rescheduled first. And the idea of a psychedelic without the hallucinogenic effect is also very exciting, because, I mean, I'm in conversations with my uncles and aunts that want to try these compounds, and they're so excited that there could be something that's not going to have them hallucinating. So different people might have different opinions on that, but I think that'll help it get to the masses.
Yeah. And generally, you know, I think MDMA being one that has shown the most clinical evidence, that's definitely one I'm excited about. But I'm also just excited for, you know, the next couple of years of science and the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of new molecules that will be created and tested. One last thing I'll say is, you know, Sasha Shulgin and Anne Shulgin were, you know, two of probably the most important scientists and chemists within the psychedelic sector. Anne Shulgin is having her memorial service. She passed away this past year, and having her memorial service this weekend, actually. You know, they just, out of a lab, created hundreds and hundreds of molecules that are still used across the entire world, people benefiting from these medicines underground. And so, you know, now with the proper capital, we're going to see thousands of molecules that are created and can really help assist people through this new lens and through these new neurochemical pathways in the body. So we're just super excited to see that field develop.
Well, thanks so much. This is a really informative discussion. Sherry and Merrick, thanks so much for joining us.